and welcome to the KMXT Weekly Wrap, where we go over this week's news from Alaska's Emerald Isle. I'm your host, Brian Benoit. In this week's recap, we hear about coordinated relief efforts for damage caused by the remnants of Typhoon Halong to western Alaska.
We have partnered with local and regional organizations to make sure that the money goes to those to the areas that it's needed most.
That's coming up.
KMXT is supported in part by the Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center, providing support for victims of domestic and or sexual violence. 907-486-6171.
But first, Kodiak is set to have both a new borough mayor and a new city mayor, as well as two new borough assembly members and two city council members, now that the election results from the 2025 municipal election are all in and counted. As KMXT's Davis Hovey reports, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly swore in its new members on Thursday night.
In the race for two Kodiak Island Borough Assembly seats, Jeremiah Gardner and Jeffrey Woods received the most votes, with 963 and 730, respectively. Both picked up an additional 70 votes after absentee, early votes, and by mail were tallied. And in the head-to-head borough mayor race between incumbent Scott Arndt and Assemblymember Jared Griffin, Griffin unseated Arndt by a margin of 180 votes after receiving more than 1,000 in total. All three candidates will be sworn in at Thursday night's Kodiak Island Borough Assembly meeting and start their three-year terms immediately. During this year's municipal election, 21% out of the roughly 10,000 registered voters in the borough voted. Same goes for the city of Kodiak, with 21% of the more than 4,000 voters casting ballots this year. Although it's still a relatively small voter turnout, this year saw more votes than any Kodiak Island Borough election in the past 3 years. Voters had several options to choose from this year, with five candidates running for Kodiak Island Borough Assembly, four on the ballot for Kodiak City Council and City Mayor, as well as two others running to be the Borough Mayor. As for the city results, it came down to three votes to determine who would win one of the City Council seats. After initially being tied at 354 votes, Juno Davidson edged out Nick Mangini to take the second seat behind top vote-getter Sandra West. The outcome for city mayor has not changed, as Councilmember Terry Haynes remains ahead of Alan Seal by more than 100 votes. The city's canvassed results are expected to be certified during the City Council's next regular meeting next week. And for transparency, both of the incoming Kodiak mayors, Griffin and Haynes, are staff members at KMXT Radio. They do not have any editorial influence over news stories, and neither of them reviewed this story before it was published. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
But despite the election, there's still one borough seat open after Ryan Sherritt resigned, citing family reasons. Four applicants put their names in to fill the rest of his term, which is about a year, including Caroline Roberts, who ran for one of the open seats this year. The borough selected her at its meeting on October 16th, but outgoing Mayor Scott Arndt told the assembly he planned to veto her appointment, although he didn't formally veto during the meeting. Arndt has mayoral powers to do so until the end of day on Sunday, according to borough code. Roberts is the population health coordinator for the Kodiak Area Native Association and has lived in Kodiak since 2022. At the Thursday meeting, the group selected Robertson to fill the vacant seat. As of Thursday night, Robertson took oath of office and was sworn in as a borough assembly member to serve until October 2026. And looking towards education news, the YMCA of Alaska started up a new after-school program at Kodiak's East Elementary School. The state has licensed the program to look after up to 74 kids from kindergarten through third grade, mainly in the school's gym, cafeteria, and library, until about 6 p.m. on weekdays. Nate Root, the CEO and president of YMCA Alaska, says the monthly cost will be $575 per kid, or in some cases lower with subsidies from the state, tribes, and the Coast Guard.
And we go through the licensing process to help with the affordability for parents being able to apply for state financial support.
Parents interested in having their kids participate in the program must register their children in advance. No drop-ins are accepted, and parents must provide transportation to and from the school. Erica Blondin is the new child care director with the Kodiak YMCA. She says the organization is sharing some staff from the Kodiak Island Borough School District to help run the after-school program.
It's great because we have to be able to have that partnership and share those employees because they have great training and are extremely know the children, especially if they're in the school that they work in.
The organization estimates it'll need about 10 staff per site, but that number depends on how many kids are signed up and on attendance. The YMCA is also working on starting after-school programs in the next couple of months at Kodiak's other elementary schools, Main and Peterson. Opening dates for those have not yet been determined. Blondin helped establish the Kodiak Collaborative earlier this year as a way to bring community members and organizations together to address local child care and after-school needs. The organization was the first to approach the YMCA of Alaska and bring them to the island. The collaborative informally surveyed residents earlier this year and found that the vast majority of the 200-plus respondents need after-school care in general for their school-aged children. Moving on towards higher education, Kodiak College held a college and career fair over the weekend, the first for the community in nearly a decade. Dozens of prospective students and workers wandered Kodiak College's campus. Recruiters represented 18 local and statewide employers, as well as 30 colleges and universities from both Alaska-based schools and from across the country. Ellen Carty, the marketing and communications coordinator, led the planning for it. She says about 150 people signed in as visitors to talk to them.
It was absolutely really steady. The people that showed up were motivated, like they wanted to know specific questions from these colleges. They were looking for specific employers. We had a really good steady flow the whole time.
Carty says many of the attendees came prepared and asking questions about credit transfers and scholarships. The college also hosted two seminars as part of the fair, one about interview skills and another for resume tips. This was the first time Kodiak College has hosted a fair like this as far back as Carty or the college's director and even some longtime staff can remember. She says it's likely the first college and career fair for the entire community since the local school district hosted one about 8 years ago. Stopping in Kodiak was exciting for some of the recruiters, too. Many of the out-of-state exhibitors head toward other Alaska Hub communities as a sort of circuit, but Kodiak hasn't been a stop on the list for years.
We had offered to be part of the circuit, so they sandwiched us in on a weekend, and once we were part of the circuit, all of these colleges decided to come to Kodiak as well because they hadn't been to Kodiak in forever.
Universities from across the Pacific Northwest sent recruiters joining in-state schools like University of Alaska Schools and Alaska Pacific University. Local companies included private employers like Alaska Aerospace, Highmark Marine, and the Kodiak Area Native Association, as well as public employers like Alaska State Parks. Despite the government being closed, some federal employers had booths too, like Coast Guard-based Kodiak's Morale, Wellness, and Recreation Department. Some of the exhibitors have already told Carty they're hoping to come back to be part of another college and career fair soon.
And they were really disappointed Kodiak wasn't on the circuit before, like really glad that it's back. Really enjoyed being here, so I'm hoping, again, next year it'll be a little bit bigger and a little bit better.
She also hopes to have more workshops and seminars to help people improve skills and land jobs and get into colleges next year. For now, she recommends students applying to colleges to also prepare by going to Kodiak College's scholarship workshops. And moving on to seafood news, an advisory has been in effect for toxic shellfish sampled across various beaches around Kodiak since at least August 15th. But on October 10th, the Kodiak Area Native Association's environmental team lifted that advisory for all shellfish species. However, KEN is not a regulatory agency, and the consumption of wild shellfish in Alaska is considered eat at your own risk. For the past 2 months, the organization has found elevated toxin levels in shellfish like blue mussels at public sites such as Mission and White Sands beaches. KEN has been sampling shellfish from at least three different sites every week and monitoring for the toxins that cause paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP. When the toxins in shellfish are above the Food and Drug Administration's regulatory limit, consumption can potentially cause PSP. Symptoms include tingling in the lips and fingertips, numbing of arms and legs, nausea, difficulty breathing, and even death. Despite the toxin advisory being lifted, KANA still encourages shellfish harvesters around Kodiak to submit a sample of their shellfish to the organization for free testing through the Harvest and Hold program. And Bering Sea crabbers will see a boost in harvest caps this season. That's after years of canceled or diminished fishing seasons due to low snow and king crab stocks. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced on October 6th that it's nearly doubling the harvest for the upcoming Bering Sea snow crab commercial fishing season from last year's totals. Fish and Game set the cap at just over 9 million pounds, a low number compared to historic levels. The catch limit was set at 45 million pounds back in 2020, the year before the snow crab stock crashed. The next year, the fishery closed for two seasons after more than 10 billion snow crabs disappeared from the region. Researchers blamed warming waters from climate change for the crash. Fish and Game now says survey results show increases in all sex and size groups compared to last year. Large males remain at historic lows, but the population is showing signs of stabilization and recovery after the recent collapse. Officials say a return to colder ocean conditions and increased numbers, especially in juvenile crab, are reasons to be optimistic. And for the first time, a portion of the harvest will be reserved for a hybrid snow tanner crab. Those are crabs that share some characteristics like eye color and tooth shape of both snow and tanner crabs. Regulators say recent surveys show an unprecedented amount of the hybrid crab and included an extra 1 million pounds on top of a base harvest specifically for that mix of snow and tanner crab species. Meanwhile, Fish and Game also boosted the Bristol Bay Red King Crab catch limit by about 16% from last year, with a total harvest of about 2.7 million pounds. Tanner crab harvests more than doubled for the Western District of the Bering Sea, but dropped by almost 40% for the Eastern area. All of those fisheries opened on October 15th. Bristol Bay Red King crab will be harvested first, as that fishery closes shortly after the new year. Snow and Tanner crab both close in the spring. And community groups and businesses across the state are coordinating relief efforts after the remnants of Typhoon Halong brought widespread devastation to Western Alaska. The storm has killed at least one person and left two missing and displaced hundreds, especially in two Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta villages. The Alaska Community Foundation has partnered with local and regional organizations to create the Western Alaska Disaster Relief Fund. The foundation's Ashley Ellington says they're distributing the funds to communities hit the hardest.
It's geared towards immediate support and then long-term resilience. And the thing that's unique about this fund is that we have partnered with local and regional organizations to make sure that the money goes to those, to the areas that it's needed most.
The fund is a partnership with the Alaska Federation of Natives, the Association of Village Council Presidents, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and a number of other groups serving Alaskans in the region. As of 1 o'clock on Tuesday, Ellingson said the fund had raised more than $300,000 from over 3,500 donors. Jenny Ragland, chair of Alaska Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster, says cash donations are a better option than goods, since storing and transporting items can present challenges of their own.
Well, it may seem impersonal. Cash really is the best opportunity to help meet those immediate needs that are coming our way. It provides flexibility for us to purchase exactly what's needed, to procure those items quickly, and to get them into the hands of disaster survivors.
You can donate to the Western Alaska Disaster Relief Fund at the Alaska Community Foundation's website. That's alaskacf.org. And a list of businesses and groups collecting goods to be shipped to the region can be found with this story at alaskapublic.org.
KMXT is supported in part by the Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center, providing support for victims of domestic and or sexual violence. 907-486-6171.
And if you enjoy the podcast and want to support local news centered around the Kodiak Archipelago, make sure to donate to KMXT. Just go on our website at kmxt.org and click the donate button in the top right corner of the page. That's it for this week's edition of the KMXT Weekly Wrap. Again, I'm your host, Brian Benoit. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in.